blood bank? If you don't have malaria, hepatitis, or TB, we'd like to have a pint of your blood.
Welcome to 200 a Day, the podcast where we talk about the 70s television detective show, The Rockford Files. I'm Nathan Paletta.
And I'm Epidiah Rabishaw.
And we are coming to you today with a bit of a, I was about to say a bit of a throwback. That doesn't make sense in the context of the show.
Yeah. Well, it's not a 90s movie.
We're coming to you today with a season one episode, and it has been quite a while, I think, since we've done season one. So there was a discernible shift in tone and style of the show coming back to this one after some of the ones we've done recently.
Our random access viewing that we've been doing has done interesting things with my brain for how I categorize the different seasons. Like I don't have a good chronological order in my head, but each season has a certain feel to it. Like the middle seasons is a little hard for me to tell, but there's a clear spectrum from season one to the six. You'd think I'd know by now.
I feel like one is very palpable. I feel like two and three, well,
those are like, I think if somebody were to ask me, like, what is, I'm just going to watch one Rockford Files season. What should it be? And I'd be like, well, let me find out where Gear Jammers starts.
Yeah.
And I'll set you down there. Yeah.
Two and three, I feel like kind of blend, even though like Chase comes on before season three. So there is that. So it's like two and three kind of feel the same in some ways. Three and four kind of feel the same in some ways. In a different way. Like I wouldn't say that two and four feel the same, but three kind of bridges them. And then I think five is like, you can tell when it's a season five episode.
Yeah.
And then six basically feels like season five, but there's less of them.
Yeah.
Didn't have as much time to get its own character.
Season five and season six, I would say wild.
Yeah.
They're wild and not like, like there are definitely shows that have gone off rails. That's not what I'm talking about. There's just like it's just a different flavor to it. But I think season one thing that I really enjoy about it is that season one is showing its roots.
Yes.
Like it really very much is like, if not taking directly from, you know, like there's in Thin Air or whatever the...
Yeah, like, the Sleight of Hand, which is the In Thin Air adaptation. Yeah.
Yeah. If they're not direct adaptations, it's clear homages or just like, this is the genre.
Of the like noir crime detective, but obviously, you know, punctured with the Zen Malboon and with Jim and with humor and all that stuff. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I suppose I should mention that that this is in fact season one, episode eight, Find Me If You Can.
Right, we should say what episode we're talking about.
And yeah, so not only season one, but early in season one. Yeah, I think that's a good observation that the roots of the show genre wise are most apparent here. And then as, you know, to extend the metaphor, as the show grows, you know, it branches, you see more above ground.
The roots are still there, but like it's not as apparent. Yeah.
Also, season one is the only season that has the Roy Huggins stories.
Right.
Because he leaves as an active contributor after the first season. So this one, in fact, is a Huggins script, or John Thomas James as his nom de plume, nom de TV, nom de vision.
Nom de plume, the plume is the feather, right? The pen, the quill. So nom de, what's French for typewriter?
Oh, I believe it's something like le typewriter because it's an English word.
Nom de typewriter.
Right. John Thomas James with the teleplay by Juanita Bartlett.
Yeah.
I think we haven't really done a Roy Huggins one in a while. His deal was basically that he would come up with an idea for a story. He would generally break it by like driving around and thinking about it and then have a dictation about like, here's the story. And then he would give it to someone to actually write to do the teleplay. But a lot of his concepts are very like, here's a germ of an idea, and then I built this entire story off of this germ.
Nom de dictaphone.
Ah, and I'm the dictaphone. This one in particular, I'll just throw it out now since I'm talking about Huggins. The storyline here is very similar to that. So this is from the Ed Robertson book. The storyline of this episode is very similar to that of Girl on the Run, which was a Roy Huggins short story that he wrote that he later adapted in 1956 as the basis for the pilot of the TV series 77 Sunset Strip.
Ah.
There was in an interview with Huggins, it says that he was not intentionally, and he did recycle stories, mm-hmm. but he was not intentionally recycling this story. It's more just the background to it was similar. So it may have been subconscious, but he was not deliberately reusing it for Rockford. We'll give the basis of it after we get into it, because that kind of gives away the fun premise. But yeah, anyway,
yeah.
As we say, we'll get to that when we get to that. This is the first appearance chronologically, but last on our viewing for director Lawrence Doheny.
Oh,
we can celebrate him for a few minutes. I didn't really find out much like backstory more than you can, or info about him more than you can kind of infer from his credits. I believe that this is because he's one of our directors who started directing in, like the, 50s. Yeah. In the late 50s. Mm-hmm. And he died in 1982. So I think there's been a couple other of these, creators on the show where it's like, well, they kind of died before the internet and fandom arose in tandem, if you will. So there's just not like a lot of art, like, I don't know. There's just not information without going into some kind of really deep dive that I'm not prepared to
nobody
to do.
Sat down and interviewed him in
you know, as a career retrospective or something, like it just wasn't kind of on the radar. So unless it's out there somewhere, I just didn't find it.
He's got some classic hits here. I was just looking through them. And,
So the 12 episodes on his roster here, I think these are in order. Yeah, I wrote these down in order of chronologically. So Find Me If You Can, which we're doing now. Mm-hmm. The Profit and Loss two-parter with Ned Beatty. That was, I think, we really liked. The 4-Pound Brick, which is a early Dennis focus episode.
That was the one that Lee Brackett wrote, right?
Yes, yeah. The Farnsworth Stratagem.
Yeah.
One of our all-time faves.
Yeah.
The Great Blue Lake Land and Development Company, which is the one where Jim ends up in the desert where there's this development that's supposed to be happening.
Yes. Is that the one where he's like, tries to put his money in, the bank is closed, so he stores it at a safe in the development company, and that's what gets it involved in it. Yeah,
because he's carrying a check on behalf of something.
Yeah,
and it goes south from there. It has the like con man who's not Angel.
Yes,
who's in it?
Yes,
and it has the dramatic helicopter chase at the end, as I'm remembering. Pastoria Prime Pick, which was another Jim out of his element early episode that we did.
You missed one.
Did I?
After the Great Blue Lake and Landville. Isn't Chicken Little is a Little Chicken?
Oh, did I just not write it down?
Oh my.
What? Turn the podcast around.
Yeah. Yeah, you did.
Oh yeah. No, I sure did. I just didn't write it down on my list. I apologize.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
We here at 200 a day would like to apologize.
And, you know, what more do we have to say about that? Pastoria Prime Pick, Joey Blue Eyes, which I really liked. The gangster one, Where's Houston, which we did recently enough for me to remember.
I don't remember it.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of a Family Hour. Where's Houston is the one where Houston is a woman whose dad is killed, I think, and it has like an oil empire.
Yes.
There's a very dramatic heart to heart, like by their pool, where Jim is talking to her about like, oh, because she's like, or maybe it's not that her dad died, whatever. She's in charge of she's had to act like a man, right? To like get through life. And then they talk about it. Anyway, I remember that part.
Yeah. The title just didn't stand out to me, I think is what it is. Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's where the title's a bit of a joke because it's about like an oil company from Texas. And then her name is Houston. Anyway. Drought at Indian Head River, which is where Angel gets conned into a land deal.
Yes. Lots of land deals.
Yeah.
Lots of land deals.
And then Peacework, which is the one we did for our last episode.
All right. Yeah, they're all like
a lot of good apps, and this one in particular, I feel like has like a lot of camera work going on,
mm-hmm.
possibly because it's a little light on like dialogue and plot.
Right. Yeah. not in a bad way. No. It's a very snappy episode.
Yeah. And then I'm also, but like, it's a wide range. Like, that's a lot of different kinds of episodes that got a reliable hand in to keep control of the camera. I feel like every time we do a director that has more than two or three episodes, it's like, oh, there's a lot of good ones there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a testament to, guess what? There's a lot of good episodes of the Rockford Files.
Yeah, it's that. And it's also, I'm not saying that the other ones, obviously, if someone does a good job directing, you ask them back.
Right.
And I'm not saying that everyone who only did like one episode did a bad job, like, because, you know, you can't always come back and do something. But it was just like, yeah, no, this is anytime you see that somebody's done a lot of Rockford Files episodes, they're probably worth paying attention to.
I'm predisposed to being like, oh, they're probably good at their job.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we get into our preview montage, just a quick shout out to patron Michael, who sent us a care package of Rockford-related ephemera. We talked about that more extensively on Plus Expenses. So if you have not listened to Plus Expenses, you can check out the Patreon to get access to it, where we go through all the cool stuff that he sent us. One of the unlooked for benefits of doing this show is all the cool stuff that people have sent us.
Yeah.
So just wanted to publicly acknowledge that, we appreciate it.
Yeah. Honestly, it's a fun way to make my friends jealous of the fact that I have a podcast.
It's like the only, what am I trying to say? It's the only way to show off.
Yeah.
That people listen to our show. Like, you can have all the numbers in the world, like all the downloads or whatever, but like, we got these like cool bootleg CD collections. We got jackets, got artwork.
Framed photos and artwork
So thanks to everyone who does. Not that we're not asking people to send us stuff.
No.
It's not why we're here. But the fact that people have done it, it's very cool. So, just want to say thank you when it does come up.
When we started this, I don't know about you, but I had zero Rockford Files memorabilia. Mm-hmm. I didn't even have DVDs. We were watching it on a streaming service.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have the whole run of the Rockford Files on DVD, including the movies. I've got mugs, T-shirts, sweaters.
I'm wearing my Paradise Cove Beach Cafe Malibu hoodie right now,
which features it, not the hoodie, but the Beach Cafe features in this episode.
True.
But yeah it's fun.
All right, that all said, we should get into our very straightforward preview montage.
We got some good things to look forward to. We've got Who Do You Want Me to Find? Me. So just right off the bat, the twist is that someone's going to hire Rockford to find themselves. There's a nice car trick. He does the little blocking the tunnel by telling the guy that there's an accident on the other side.
It's a moment that works great on the screen and is incredibly awkward to describe.
Yeah, I was talking to friends about it. Not only that, but like, we're on our way to losing the context for that. Because that whole exchange is predicated on the lack of cell phones.
Right. And the willingness of strangers to help you.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot going on there. It's a really good exchange between him and Rocky in total when we get to it. But like the line about 2 inches to the right and you would have lost your eye. And he's like, yeah, but 2 inches to the left, it would have missed me completely.
That's probability for you.
And this is another thing that I think season one has more of, but we get Jim, the practical side of Jim in dialogue, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he gets she's like, what kind of man are you? He's like, careful. I'm a careful man. Like, I don't want to get killed. And the hint of gunplay, which you want to know before you get into the episode.
200 a Day is a 100% listener supported show. Thanks to our patrons. In addition to our gratitude and editing access to the 200 Files spreadsheet, patrons receive exclusive episode previews every month and Plus Expenses, our bonus podcast where we talk about media, work, and our lives. In addition, every episode, we say thank you to our Gumshoe patrons. Brian Burnson has a Facebook page where he drives his Rockford tribute car to shooting locations from the show. facebook.com/BrianRockfordFiles. Chuck Soufel's one-shot comic, Sherlock Holmes and the Wonderland Conundrum, is available at whatyoureadingpress.com. Find Dale Norwood's book, Trading Freedom, How Trade with China Defined Early America, wherever good books are sold. It's about fast ships, cheap drugs, and American political economy, published by the University of Chicago Press. Join Mitch Hampton to examine all matters aesthetic and what it means to be human at the Journey of an Aesthete podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Paul Townend also recommends the podcast Fruit Loops, Serial Killers of Color, at fruitloopspod.com. Shane Liebling has all of your online dice rolling needs covered at his website, rollforyour.party. And check out Jay Adon's amazing miniature painting skills over at jayadon.com. Thank you to Andre Apignani, Tom Clancy, Pumpkin Jabba Peach Pug, Dave P., Dave Otterson, Kip Hawley, Dale Church, Colleen Kelly, David Nixon, Nathan Black, Robert Lindsay, and Jay Thompson. And finally, special appreciation for our detective level patrons, Joe Greathead, Michael Zalisco, Eric Antenor, Brian Pereira, Jordan Bockelman, not Brockelman, Bill Anderson, and of course, Richard Haddam. If you're interested in keeping us going for as little as $1 an episode, check out patreon.com/200a day to see if becoming a patron is right for you. Well, we start our episode on a high note, which is unfortunately just, I really thought this was going to come back, and I'll say when that was later, but we start our episode focused on a very good boy or girl, a very good doggo on the beach, wandering up to Jim's trailer while there's freeze frames for credits over part of the sequence. So this dog just kind of comes up to the trailer, runs past it, and goes past a cab that's pulling up on the street. Cab pulling up on the street, you say? This is, again, early in the show, and the things like both the spatial location and also the location for shooting, I think, has not been locked down yet. So this particular version, he's across the street from storefronts of some kind. There's like an art store and something else. And that threw me for a second because I was like, oh, did he move the trailer? And then I realized, no. The parking lot area looks about the same as it always does. But it's not in the same kind of relationship to other buildings that we're used to. But the point is that this dog runs past a cab, and we have a zoom in on who we know from our preview montage to be the client for the episode. This is Joan Van Ark, the actress. We've seen her in Resurrection in Black and White, where she was Susan the reporter.
Right. Yes.
So this is our episode 73. I remember talking about how she has really good chemistry with Garner, and that was kind of like one of the highlights of that episode. So I was excited to see her. Her final appearance is yet to come in our ordering, so we're not done with her yet. And she's all over TV, but she's a soap opera star. Knots Landing, and then later Young and the Restless for a while. So a pleasure to see her, because I have fond memories of her last appearance.
This episode is very familiar to me, and I think she's one of the reasons why I was like, have we seen this one before? I mean, I have seen them. I've seen them all before, but like, it felt recent enough to have been part of the podcast, but she was. And the other guy in this scene was.
You mean
Jim?
You mean Jim
Rockford? Yeah.
Well, we go into the trailer, which again is the season one trailer, where it just like looks unfinished to me. But, it just hasn't been
lived in yet.
Yeah, lived into to what we get used to in later seasons. The important thing here is that Jim is on the phone to his bank because he's trying to straighten out an account issue in an extremely relatable fashion.
He wants them to not cash a check until the next day. That was it. It's a great sweet talk.
There's a check. He thought he was going to have money from whatever or something. He doesn't have it yet. He's supposed to have it first thing in the morning. It'll go in his account, and then can you cash the check?
Yeah.
He's talking to a teller. He's like, can you just drop it behind a file drawer or something? I'm not asking you to do anything dishonest. Just like wait like 16 hours and then everything will be fine. If I bounce that check, he's like, it's going to ruin my credit rating.
Yes.
And he frowns. Everybody has a credit rating. of the teller being like, what credit rating? Sounds like he gets an agreement. He hangs up the phone as there's a knock on the door, and this woman comes in, says that her name is Florence Baker. She wants to talk business. She saw his ad in the Yellow Pages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get all the good stuff right off the bat. You know, I'm happy to talk as long as my price. I think he says as long as my price doesn't drive you away.
I charge $200 a day plus expenses.
She's a little shocked by that. She's like two, but agrees to it.
So she, as outlined in the preview montage, she wants to hire Jim to find her.
Yes.
Roy Huggins is quoted as saying, the story began simply with that idea. Somebody comes up to Rockford and says, I want to know if I can be found. I won't tell you a thing about me, but I want to know whether I can be found. That's good. It's a strong premise.
It's a great premise. Jim is right out of the bat with questions.
Yeah.
And what I love about it is that, like, of course. I mean, of course he's got questions. Like, why? Why?
I mean,
why?
He even says, like, this is a weird request. I don't think a couple of questions are out of line.
But also, it's also clear that that's against the rules of the game, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if I were to pay Jim to find me, the last thing I would do would be answer any questions, right? That's not a good test.
She has $600 that she's going to give mm-hmm. Jim to basically have him work till that runs out.
Yeah.
He could really use 600 bucks right now, so that seems like,
yes.
You know, it's a
why
good
not?
Context for us to have. Jim wants to know who's looking for her, and that she seems nervous, wants to know why she seems so nervous. These are the questions that he mm-hmm. thinks are not out of line. I need help, and I'm willing to pay for it. What more does it take to get on your client list? Fair yeah. enough. I appreciate that she gives him a couple tips, since, as she says, your time is my money, which is a great, great Rockford Files line.
Yeah.
I didn't give you my real name. I'm not driving a car, so you can't check my license plate.
Right.
You can't talk to the taxi driver. He won't tell you anything. Like, you know, I gave him money not to tell you anything. I'm going to take some cabs, maybe some buses. I don't want your job to be difficult. I want it to be impossible.
Yeah.
Jim replies, well, in that case, I think we both need a drink. And we have a slow zoom to the empty glass in front of her while he gets an ice bucket.
Yeah.
So in that moment, like, all right. I mean, I guess, like, it feels like a out of character, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
But we learned very soon that there is a good reason.
Yes.
So we go from that kind of zoom into the glass to downtown Jim talking to his good friend, Dennis Becker, who is happy to do this favor for him because there are no forms to fill out. And so the favor was Jim brought a set of her prints for him to run. And thus the glass now makes sense. That's where he got her fingerprints. So love that setup reveal.
Yeah, that's good. Visual storytelling, right? Like it's not explained or anything like that. It's just, good stuff.
And I think this is one of the Huggins / first season qualities. Jim does a lot more like detecting.
Yes.
in these early episodes.
This is a good episode for, seeing how he works.
Yeah. More like tradecraft stuff.
Yeah, and tradecraft. Like,
seeing him think on his feet and have plans and all that good stuff.
And then relying on backup plans because the plans don't work.
Becker passed the prints on to a buddy of his in the fingerprinting department, mm-hmm. I guess. It was a perfect set. We couldn't have done better if we booked her. however, before he gives any information, he extorts Jim's Laker tickets in exchange.
I love that he sets up a play date with Rocky.
Right.
He's like, you know how long it's been since I've seen your old man? He's not only going to the Lakers, but he's making sure Jim can't.
Right. He specifically wants to go to the Lakers game without Jim.
Yeah.
So he'll take the two tickets so that he goes with Rocky.
Yeah.
So good. I'll take him out to dinner. It'll be on me. so good.
There's like a certain confidence to Dennis here because he knows he's got something.
Yeah.
He's not letting Jim know that that he's got something. He's just like almost like saying, you're going to give me those Laker tickets. and then Jim does. Yeah.
Hey, Dennis. Dennis, you wouldn't boost an apple off a pushcart. How come you're always hustling me?
You're a friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, Dennis does not have that simmering anger that I think he develops over time. It's nice. It's kind of seeing like, oh yeah,
they can be friends.
You can extort each other because you're friends. All right. So the information that he has, and this is a good humorous beat. We ran the prints, no warrants. She has no criminal record in the county of LA. And Jim's like, okay, give me those tickets back. I sent them over to my friend in Sacramento.
Yeah.
And she has no criminal record in the state of California. But, you know, we were able to check with the thumbprint database to get her driver's license. So name, birthday, residence, etc. So it does give Jim something. So he does end up giving up those liquor tickets.
Well, I guess this will happen in the next scene. But this is definitely a you're not paying for the amount of time that he's working. You're paying for all the experience that he's bringing to the job situation, right?
Or at least the contacts that he has established over the years and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
We cut to Jim in a church. There are a lot of like dramatic upshots of Jim in the first half of this episode. Yeah. In the trailer we established, like with an upshot, we could see the ceiling over him, which we almost never see in the trailer. In this, we have this upshot at the front of the church, and he's kind of like looming. It's kind of an interesting approach. She obviously called to meet, and he sits behind her in the pews, and he gives her back an envelope with $367, $200 for the day, and his expenses are itemized.
Yeah, I love it.
That's what, $33 in expenses?
Yeah. I wonder if he charged her for the Laker tickets. It's hard to tell. He's like, what I love about this is that he has the $600 in hand. And I think it's a little bit of a point of pride that he's only taking what it took. Like, he's like, this is such an easy job.
Well, and he's also trying to make a point of like, I'm not going to get strung along.
Yeah.
It's not worth this additional money to me.
Yeah.
So, right. She's like, but you're not done yet. He's like, aha, but I got your name. So her name is Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
He has her address, her date of birth, a couple other details. I think she's like, how did you find that out? I'm not going to tell you. But she wants him to keep working. And he says, well, that's all. I'm giving you your money back. I found out this information about you. And that's all I'm going to do, unless you tell me what's going on.
I can't tell you. That's the whole point. It wouldn't work if I told you.
And I won't work if you don't.
Yeah.
He wants to know why she's scared, and because if she's scared, he wants to know if he should be scared too.
Yes.
She offers him another $600 because he's found out who she is, but he hasn't found her yet. Again, the rules of the game here, right? Like,
yeah.
She gets to call these meetings, but once she leaves, he still needs to like physically find where she is.
At the beginning of this scene, he yells at her for calling him and telling him where to meet her and then not even waiting for
a response. Yeah. Like, I'll tell you yes or no.
Yeah. And then the way this ends, which I think just a wonderful moment of facial acting, the eye roll in the church, the eye roll to the heavens when Jim accepts the envelope of just full of money. Everything about this scene is Jim saying, I don't like this. I don't want to be a part of it. And then he's like, I got to take the money.
It's a combination because it's the money, but it's also she gives him enough worry.
Yeah, he's afraid for her. Yeah.
She is scared. She can't tell him why, but if he walks away from her now, she's dead. And so that combined, I think, with the additional $600 gets him to stay on track. There was a line here where she says that, like, I can't tell you. That's the whole point. It won't work if I tell you. I don't know if that's true once we get through the reveal.
I was thinking about that while we were watching it, while I was watching it. And I think it's more of a, if he knows, then someone can get something out of him. But no, that's not true, because what she's not telling him is...
Maybe we'll revisit this point later. But
oh, I think she's trying to avoid him going to the people that are looking for her.
Which is what he ends up doing, so...
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess there's a level of disclosure that would still do that. I don't know. We can talk about it. We go to the Firebird and we have our score kicking back in. This is when I realized a lot of this is without music, except for when we're on the road. When Jim hits the road, we get music. And then when he's like walking around and talking to people, it's all pretty much very naturalistic. But he's heading to Pacific Grove, which is, I guess, where he figured out that she was where she grew up, goes into the police station. He wants to know if there's a missing persons out on Barbara. I didn't write it down.
Kelbaker.
Barbara Kelbaker.
I mean, he must have said the name throughout the episode.
He did.
It never clicked in my head.
Barbara's just easier to write down. He gets a little bit of resistance. He's like, look, I'm not asking for secrets. I'm not trying to get anything confidential. I just want to find out, you know, what I can about this. And he does a great cold read on this cop that he's talking to.
Yeah. Oh, so good.
Who I thought was going to do a classic, like, PI, get out of here thing. But it turns out that, because he says, like, I'm just trying to find out if Barbara's in trouble. And this cop says, if she'd asked me a year ago, I could have told her that she was in trouble. This cop that Jim's talking to also grew up there, went to high school with her.
Yeah.
Mentions a him, like, never liked him. Barbara followed him to Denver, and he has too much money. If it was up to the cop, he would keep him out of the golf tournament. The Pro-Am golf tournament in Monterey. So Jim, like, basically acts like he knows what the guy is talking about. We are learning this information with Jim. And then he finishes off with what does this have to do with Mr. Iaconelli? Who's that? My client. You're not working for Ralph Carell? Never heard of him.
It's so good.
Good cold read information gathering here.
I looked up this actor because he was very familiar to me. Mm. And I don't know why. I don't know why he's familiar to me. He's in a Columbo episode.
He is, yeah. He's in Police Story. Are you a big Police Story fan?
I don't know. But, like, I Googled him because he doesn't have a photo on IMDb. And, like, yeah, he's just super familiar to me. So I have to have seen him. Or he's reminded me of someone else. But, like the first image that shows up of him is him from this episode. So maybe I'm just thinking of someone else that he looks like. But anyways, I love this scene. It again, we were just talking about how it's all this episode has a lot of good tradecraft, and it's fun because you realize that's what he's doing partway through it. Mm-hmm. You're like, Jim's just keeping this conversation going until he can get some information, and then he puts the button on it by getting him to reveal the name of who he thinks Jim's been hired by.
Yeah, he lets the guy think that Jim already knows the information that he is giving.
Yeah.
So Jim goes to Denver. Jim going out of town was not telegraphed in the preview montage. Yeah. So I was like, oh,
that's true.
Okay. Jim has arrived at Carell Enterprises, Inc. And he goes into, there's a kind of receiving room with a secretary type by the name of Wyatt manning the desk. He has been in this kind of role in another Rockford Files. He has a very recognizable face.
Jimmy Lydon.
He was also in Joey Blue Eyes.
Ah, so he's done work with our director.
Twice, yeah. Anyhow, Jim claims to be Jim Rockford from Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. He met Mr. Carell at the Pro-Am, and he said if he was ever in Denver to look him up. Wyatt says, well, sorry, you don't have an appointment. There's some good banter. Don't you have to look that up in a little book? I happen to know Mr. Carell's schedule very well. So he's like, well, I don't think he'll take it well to know that I'm cooling my heels out here and he doesn't even know I came to see him. So Wyatt goes in to tell Mr. Carell, comes back out with Vinny, who is exactly what you mentally picture when a goon named Vinny comes out. And tells him to show Jim to the door. Mr. Carell didn't meet you in Monterey. He doesn't know who you are. Stymied on his first approach.
Jim gives up,
and that's the end of our episode. No, as he's leaving, he sees in the lobby that there's an elevator that goes directly to the penthouse suite. So he makes a phone call from the public phone to the penthouse suite, claims to be building security. There's been a report of a gas leak, and there's a routine safety precaution to evacuate the building. We cut to Carell, Wyatt, and who we soon learned to be Carell. Mm-hmm. Wyatt and Vinny pacing down the hall to the elevator while Carell's spitting out orders about things to do while they're disrupted. The doors open. We see that Jim is tucked into the front corner to obscure himself.
He's a Dark Souls. I mean, that's just the room, the video game Dark Souls. You walk into a room, there's always somebody tucked in that spot to attack you.
And so he jumps out, attacks.
Yes.
I guess Wyatt, he shoves him back and says, you know, occupied, some witticism, so mm-hmm. that he ends up in the elevator alone with Ralph Carell. Carell is played by Paul Michael Glaser. Is it Glaser or Glasser?
That is a good question.
I don't think I've actually heard it pronounced. Anyway, Starsky.
Yeah.
Starsky from Starsky and Hutch. I was checking out his IMDb, and I didn't know that he also was a director.
Oh.
And in addition to TV, he directed the trio. How about this trio of movies? The Running Man,
mm-hmm.
The Cutting Edge,
mm-hmm.
and Kazam. That was his trio of major motion pictures.
Wow.
Right?
Who loves you and who do you love? That's range. Wow, The Cutting Edge.
I've never seen The Cutting Edge. I kind of know about it as a bit of a meme.
Yeah.
Running Man, obviously a stone cold classic in its own way.
Yeah.
And then Kazam, subject to the Mandela effect of a movie.
Yeah.
Remembering Shazam. Does this come up in your life?
Yeah. This is people thinking it's I can't think of his name.
Sinbad.
Yeah.
That there's a movie called Shazam
mm-hmm.
with Sinbad, but that doesn't exist. Even
no.
though I feel like I remember it. But that movie does not exist. There is a movie called Kazam with Shaq.
And yeah.
That is this movie.
Now, Running Man's one of those that has, like, it takes place like 2 or 3 years ago.
It was one where, like, back when Twitter was, I hesitate to say good, but back when Twitter mm-hmm. was what it was. It was in the year where people were posting the screenshot of, like,
the title. The opening title, yeah. Or
the year is 2019.
Yes. And the food riots and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And, like, we were so on the edge. We didn't know. We were like, haha, look at this. Oh.
The red screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, with, like, the blocky computer text.
Yeah, it's good.
Oh, it's 2017. Okay, so the Running Man takes place in 2019, but the screen is, by 2017, the world economy has collapsed. Food, natural resources, and oil are in short supply. Police state dive into paramilitary zones, rules with an iron hand. Yep, so I guess that was 2017. Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's all of 7 years ago.
Around when this couple of knuckleheads decided to
start a rocker files.
So that was when Twitter was good, because that's why we... Oh my goodness gracious. Okay. Wow. 2017. All right. Anyway.
Back in the year 1974.
So Ralph Carell's character trait is how he dresses, which I think is a connection to our last episode, Piecework, with our our well-dressed informer protagonist. And he has a pocket watch that he pulls out of his waistcoat every so often, which is another like little affectation.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Jim tells him he's looking for Barbara. He says on behalf of her mother, she's gone missing. There's like no reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And then he replies that Jim's in way over his head. Pulls out his pocket watch. You have 30 seconds to let me out of this elevator. Jim makes a point of saying that he doesn't seem upset or surprised to hear Barbara might be in trouble.
I'm going to give you exactly 30 seconds to let me out of here. 30 seconds from now.
If I don't?
I'm filing charges against you.
For impersonating a maintenance man?
For unlawful detention, harassment, and assault with intent to do bodily harm. You left a hall full of witnesses upstairs.
There's a little bit of like, are you the kind of person that knows...
Right, yeah.
He's how to do this or what? Yeah. And I think Jim establishes that he's dealing with, like, you know, some kind of operator.
Yeah, he's got a good line about it coming up, but yeah.
Jim lets him out. On his way out, he says, you and Barbara must have had a beautiful relationship. Carell, I'll remember you.
Count on it. It's good. Yeah, this is, you know how... like how a Columbo episode where you're like, oh, I cannot wait to see this sparring.
Uh-huh.
That's what this did for me. I was like, yeah, I want to see Jim go up against this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Not like in a fist fight. Although, I mean, honestly, would not be disappointed with that either.
Right. He has a confidence that is very like, I don't know if you know what you're getting yourself into, Jim.
Yeah, exactly. And And there's a, what's the word I'm looking for here? He's different from, say, our urban horticulturist right. from Chicken Little. He's holding something back. Instead of this scene turning into him having his goons grab Jim right away or anything like that, he's already got plans going. You can tell that he's going to use Jim, and that'll pan out in a little bit. But like, so it just feels, he both feels like a character that can do massive violence to you, but also won't do it just because you've upset him.
Right.
He's going to keep his cool, and he's going to try to accomplish what he needs to accomplish. And I like that. It makes him a nice foil for Jim, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah, he's a discernible villain.
Yeah.
He kind of has a personality that is not quite like any of the other ones yeah. that I can recall. Anyway, this is just Jim in his disguise of the maintenance uniform facing off against Ralph Carell.
Putting Ralph Carell's snappy dressing in stark contrast, too. Like, it's good stuff. The dressing bit, right? Like, last episode we did with Piecework, we had this character who dressed well, and that was his whole thing, and he made the...
that was his entire personality.
But, like, it was an affectation that he used to declare a status higher than what he was. Mm. This guy is dressing really well, and it makes him stand out, but, I was expecting him to just be, like, a snob about something or something else, but that's not it at all. Yeah, he's just got a nice confidence to him.
He is comfortably entrenched in that social status
yeah.
that our other character was trying to climb.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We go from here to Jim's trailer. He's rummaging around as the phone rings. Apparently it's the fourth time that Barbara's called. But Jim, he's been in Denver. Oh, so... you know, when she originally hired him, he told her, you know, for missing persons, only if it's a closed case.
Right, yeah.
So here he says, you know, you lied to me. If Ralph Carell is involved, the police are involved.
The police are involved.
He's family. And we know from context, he's the mob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his line is, I thought this is great. He's like, he puts on a nice legitimate front, but he's family.
Yeah.
You get that in the previous scenes where Jim is trying to figure out who he is and what, like that whole elevator bit. It's like, no, this guy's mobbed up.
She knew just what he'd turn up, and he doesn't appreciate being used, especially when he's the only one who doesn't know what's going on. But she says she still can't tell him, and as long as the money lasts, he's working for her. And she hangs up. So still very amorphous about
yeah.
what her deal is.
She's got a great thing going here. Like, this is why Jim was trying to hand her money back to her, is that she has this hold over him as the money, and she can hang up and he can't call her back
unless he finds her.
Right. Yeah, that's just it.
We go to seeing a slick black car pulling up outside the trailer. Then we see Jim walking across the parking lot with a bag of groceries.
What could happen?
Tension rises.
Jim with a bag of groceries. Nothing could go wrong there.
Two goons get out of the car, approach Jim, claim to be FBI. He says, is this about Barbara? They say, it is. Can we talk inside? Jim being very agreeable, perhaps suspiciously agreeable. He hands his grocery bag to one of the goons, says, don't drop that. My dinner's in there.
You setting up a screenshot for me? I can tell. I can feel it.
As that goon is holding the bag of groceries, Jim crouches down to unlock his door and then pops up, gives him the sucker punch, takes a gut punch from the first goon. And then there is a traditional meaty, smacky brawl.
That is a good screenshot.
Yeah, I scanned until I found the best version.
Oh, that's so good. For our audience, this is Jim at his door with his trailer behind him, which is covered in rust. Jim, come on.
Well, we know his door has to get replaced, you know, at some point in the next couple of seasons from in another episode. So maybe this is, you know, leading up to that.
And so you've got two well-dressed men standing there, and Jim with wide ties, I should point out.
That's important.
Yeah, that's important. And one of them is falling backwards with groceries in his hands. It's clear that Jim is just finishing the punch, the follow through on the punch. And the look on Jim's face, so determined. Like, he punched that actor, right? Like, that.
Well, I was scanning through it. I'm like, this is a perfectly placed, as I would say, a working punch. It's perfectly placed so that as you, because I'm going frame by frame to find the best screenshot. Mm-hmm. And as his hand passes, the guy's a pro. So as his hand passes the guy's chin, he's moving exactly correctly to look like he got punched. But if you moved 90 degrees, I think you would see the air right between the.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's so good.
This episode, you know, a lot of times we talk about like this episode is worth it for this character alone or that character, whatever. This episode is worth it for the sucker punches alone. Mm. There are a lot of good sucker punches in this episode. And
just a moment about these goons, because these are full professional goons here. The guy who got punched, the character's name is Broder, and he's played by an actor named Tony Epper. He was an uncredited, they're both uncredited in this episode. He's also an uncredited goon in Feeding Frenzy and Kill the Messenger. So we're finishing him. The other one, the one in the dark suit in that picture who was talking to Jim, the character's name is Howard. He's played by George Fisher. And this is also our last Rockford appearance for him. He was also in To Protect and Serve, and he was one of the Middle Eastern goons in 3-Day Affair with a 30-Day Escrow.
Yeah.
And then he had a credited role as Lowball Pete in Drought at Indian Head River. So I assume he was one of the gangsters in that. Anyway, both of these guys are stunt guys. So in addition to their many, many uncredited TV appearances in roles such as this, they both have extensive stunt and stunt coordinator credits, including on some pretty, pretty big movies. So it's kind of interesting to just have this pair of extremely good goons.
Yeah, they're good. There's a great line Jim has for one of them later on. He's like, does this even talk?
Yeah, I think that's Broder. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
Here, Jim is starting to get the better of the brawl with Howard. And then Broder, so Howard's wearing a dark suit and Broder's wearing a tan suit. That's the other way to tell them apart. Broder manages to come to his feet and he pulls his pistol out and pistol whips Jim in the back of the head. And that's what ends the fight, unfortunately for Jim.
But we knew that was going to happen because he was approaching. He had groceries in his hands.
Yeah, we knew. We have this kind of swimmy coming back to consciousness perspective shot from where Jim's kind of slumped over, first seeing these two goons hovering over him again in a big dramatic upshot. And then we pull away to see Carell, of course, skimming a newspaper, waiting for Jim to wake up. They're in like an attic or something. It's like a weird location. Yeah. And this is when I think Jim looks up at, Broder. Does that talker just hit?
Yes.
So Jim has a big, like, bloody cut next to his eye, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a shot in here later where it's a close-up on the two goons and they both also have big like bruises and cuts.
Yeah.
So that's nice. I like that we get to see that Jim, you know, got some
him over. Yeah.
Carell says that he hasn't dropped the hammer on anyone in quite a while, but I may do this one myself.
Because I jumped your friends. I mean, I didn't know they were with you. I just know that feds still wear narrow ties.
Yes, it's so good.
They said they were feds. I'm like, I bet they're goons. And Jim had the immediate read based on ties alone.
The ongoing, because this comes up in other episodes where the feds' fashion or the cars that they choose follow behind what the mafia by a few years. Like there's, it's cyclical and you just keep going back and forth and you just have to keep on top of which side's using which.
Carell wants to know who hired Jim. And Jim, under the threat of more punishment, ends up telling the truth, which I think is also calculated because he still wants to know what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's like, Barbara hired me to find her. She wants to know if she can be found. If I could come up with a lie, don't you think I would give it to you?
Yeah.
Carell really seems to think about it and then goes, no, this makes sense. If you could find her, I could find her. Why would he want to find her? She's still 50 grand off of me. We have a little flash of temper.
Yeah. Yeah. This is good in retrospect later on.
Yeah.
Because this isn't why he's trying to find her. This is just a good
as an excuse.
Yeah. I mean, she did do this.
Mm-hmm.
This 50 grand is in the frame or whatever, but like, this is not why this is happening.
Of course he wants to know where she is, and Jim, I haven't found her.
Yeah.
Don't you think I would tell you if I knew? Yeah, I can't give you information I don't know. We got to do the whole number with you, huh, Rockford? But after a little back and forth, this is, again, I think a memorable kind of bit for this character where he seems to like really think about things.
Yeah.
And he has this kind of like restraint.
Yeah.
You don't know where she is, do you?
Mm-hmm.
He tells the goons, I'm done with them. And Jim's like, hey, now, that's just a figure of speech.
Yeah. That got carried away. Yeah.
But yeah, Garrel, he's like, there is this element just from these two scenes, this element of like proportionate response that he seems to be very thoughtful about.
He has something he's trying to accomplish, and he won't be goaded into ruining that.
It's time for us to take our traditional intermission, as we all need a little break to head out to the lobby, take a little stretch, get a snack, a drink, reflect on what's come before, and anticipate what's to come in this episode of the Rockford Files. We also like to take this time to remind you of where else you can find us on the internet. Epi, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me at my website, dig1000holes.com. That's 1000 the number. Or you can find me as Epidiah on the Mastodon instance dice.camp or on co-host. Where can our listeners find you, Nathan?
All of my games, zines, podcast projects, and other work are at ndpdesign.com. You can also find me at NDP on co-host and over on Instagram at ndpdesign.games. And of course, you can always find this show, 200 a day, at 200aday.fireside.fm.
And now we return to the continuing adventures of Jimmy Rocco.
We go to the trailer. Jim sees that Rocky is there, tells him to open up soon as the door opens. You see some spare ribs down there? So he still has a big bloody cut on his face. Rocky's looking at it, and Jim's just ignoring it, asking about his dinner that fell on the ground.
Hey, did you see any spare ribs around here?
See them? They was all over the place.
You didn't eat them?
I just threw them out.
Damn, Rocky, that's $4.25.
This is where I really thought that we were going to see the dog again stealing the spare ribs.
Yeah.
But no, curses. That was denied to me.
Even with inflation, $4.25 seems cheap. Well, no, it wouldn't be because it's uncooked. It's not that he bought a meal. He just bought spare ribs.
That's what cook. It's like $20 worth of spare ribs.
Meat. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have never bought spare ribs in my entire life, so I don't know how much it costs. But I did buy two burritos last night, and it was roughly $4.25 in 1974 money. If I had invested the $4.25 in 1974, I would have been able to afford the two burritos I bought last night.
Though, as Jim's accountant, you do have some good insights into his cash flow situation here. I kind of feel like, well, I got all this cash in hand. I'm gonna blow some on spare ribs. All right, so this scene with Rocky.
Oh, it's good.
There's a rich text in this scene.
Yeah.
That is good here, but also I think blooms in context of.
Yeah.
Especially season one.
Rocky is more disapproving of his job and specifically trying to get him to drive big rigs.
Right.
Like, I feel like he drops the big rig thing. I couldn't tell you what season.
By season three, Rocky has been getting brought into Jim's operations.
Yeah, kind of enjoys doing it.
Yeah, it's kind of let go of, other than the occasional, like, you keep putting yourself into trouble, you know.
Yeah.
But here, so it stood out to me because it's been so long since we've seen it, but it's totally consistent with season one.
Yeah, exactly.
So first of all, they go inside. Jim tells Rocky, don't start on me. This isn't as bad as it looks. And he says, I like what I do. Generally, this excluded, but generally, he likes what he does. He doesn't want to push a rig, so don't wave a want ad in my face.
Yeah.
Right off the bat with the don't give me that right now, which clearly is why Rocky is there.
Yeah, yeah.
But Rocky decides to try a different tack, and instead of just criticizing him off the bat, starts talking about his friend, who is also a retired trucker, who is getting bored in retirement and wants to open a hardware store. And Rocky's like, I don't know if I want to take his offer. he was clearly going to tell Jim, hey, you should do this. But
yeah.
Since Jim started off, he's like, well, I guess I'll pretend like this is something I'm thinking about.
Rocky's tact here is wonderful because Jim comes in defensive and then Rocky just ignores it, forcing Jim to force the hand on it.
Right.
Like, Jim wants the fight about it. I don't, like, there's a thing going on inside Jim where he's like, I don't want Rocky to be to badger me about this anymore. But also, it's worse if he ignores it.
He keeps showing Rocky other injuries on his head and asking him, like, how does this look? And Rocky's like, eh, probably a stitch. Like, just giving him nothing. Like,
yeah, it's great.
So I think that gets to Jim. He's like, so he finally turns to Rocky as he's leaving and says, what's wrong with you?
What's the matter with you, Rocky? The two gorillas beat me into the ground and all you can talk about is hardware.
Because I am tired of talking to you. You don't listen to nothing I say anyway. Look at your face. Look at that eye. 2 inches to the right and you'd be missing that eye.
Yeah, but look at it this way. 2 inches to the left, you'd have missed me completely.
I guess if you only ever watched this episode, it would be a little jarring.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be a little like, what's up right, with him?
Yeah. Who is this guy?
Yeah, but I think in context of season one, you're seeing Rocky slowly try different gambits to try and express to Jim how much he's worried about him. The second half of the scene after Rocky leaves is the phone ringing. And again, a bit of a like a tradecraft thing. He answers it. We're only hearing his side, but he's immediately like, don't say anything. Take down this number. Call me there. He hangs up, goes over to the restaurant. We just go to the interior. So we can assume this is the sandcastle. But, you know, again, it's a location that, we see in various forms over the course of the show. The phone is ringing. Jim waves off the busboy or whatever because he's like, oh, that's for me. So Barbara was calling him, but Jim says that his phone might be bugged. Ralph is a busy man.
Yeah.
Hence the runaround. So he tells her that he got picked up, talked to Ralph. Now that she knows Ralph is looking for her, that's all she needed.
Mm-hmm.
She's sorry that Jim got hurt. She never meant that. Tells him to keep the rest of the money. He won't be hearing from her again. Jim says that there's two sides to everything. Carell says you stole $50,000. Mm-hmm. She comes back with, I didn't steal anything. I just reclaimed myself. She's sorry he's hurt. She's sorry about a lot of things. And then, you're not somebody I want to say goodbye to. And hangs up. We cut to Jim reacting to being hung up on. And then we cut back to her to end the scene where she kind of like lets out a sob after she hangs up the phone. And then we have a brief tracking shot of Jim walking on the beach sadly at night smoking a cigarette. It's a down note for both of them,
and it's a good quote to sample for our final episode. You're not somebody I want to say goodbye to.
And then a sob.
And then we'll break down crying.
Mm-hmm. Plot wise here, like, mm-hmm. it's not like there's more that we're really going to, I mean, there is one more thing that we're going to learn, but
one more twist. Yeah,
but it's more about motivation than about like
right
content. So if we're taking her at her word,
mm-hmm.
she knows that Ralph Carell is looking for her. Jim has not found her. So I guess she can infer that he isn't able to find her, but he is looking for her. And the whole point of hiring Jim, well, I guess it was twofold. It was to ensure that she can't be found, but also to kind of be a stalking horse to discover if Carell is looking for her.
Yeah.
Does that seem?
I think so. Like, because her next move here is to flee the country.
So in the next scene, Jim's in his trailer. He has a glass mm-hmm. of milk and a little charcuterie plate. some sliced meats and some other items. The phone rings. He does the runaround with the sandcastle phone again because it's Barbara. She needs him for something. She's close to the Mexican border, but has to see him. So she'll mm-hmm. reserve a room for him outside of San Diego. And whatever you do, make sure you're not followed. Whatever you do, don't lead them to me. So I guess the read here is like, is she in love with Jim? Is that what we're supposed to be getting at this point?
There's the thing about her character, right? Like, because we'll get some stuff at the end, too, which makes it like pretty her relationship with Ralph.
Mm-hmm.
She comes comes across as pretty independent, but I think she also strings Jim along with a lot of like, and he comments on it in a bit of like, I won't live without your help.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's hard. At this point, I'm like, is this some sort of guilt trip thing? Is she trying to get Jim to do something? Or yeah, like you said, is she falling in love with him? Or
in the moment, it's like you're just kind of watching to see what happens next, right?
Yeah.
But so it's the going back through it to kind of think through what's going on. And it's not in a way where I'm like, oh, this wasn't thought of. It's more like there's enough going on with her character that I'm willing to buy a lot of different explanations. I'm not sure that we ever get any of them, though. So it's a little bit of like having to infer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess we'll get to that in a second. Because before we get to that, we get our good good semi-chase. Not chase with semi-trucks, but small chase.
Small chase. Hemi chase.
We get our good on-the-road music. I think our most iconic Rocksteady music of the episode is in this sequence. So Jim's supposed to go to San Diego. We have an establishing shot of Highway 1 North, which, you know, is away from San Diego. Sure enough, he's being followed. We see our two goons following him. Jim sees them following him.
Nice percussion in the music to let us know that something's going to happen.
I noticed that there's a lot of camera movement in this sequence, like a lot of like the camera swinging around the car while we're watching Jim, like that kind of stuff. It's very fluid and dynamic, which is nice because it's actually pretty short. Jim pulls off the highway, takes like an access road or something that looks like it's going to go underneath. It's not an aqueduct, but there's a little bridge that the highway goes over, and underneath it's just a concrete rectangle with a hole in it. So this is the bit that we also get in the preview montage. Jim pulls through. There's a truck that's just sitting there. I backed up just to see if it was telegraphed. It really wasn't, but you can infer that Jim saw the truck from the highway, and that's why he decided to turn there.
It doesn't matter too much. It's just, when did Jim make his decision, right? Mm-hmm. Like, did he turn off just to attempt to turn off, saw the truck and took that opportunity, or did he see the truck as he was coming along the road and was like, I'm going to use that?
If there was one like perspective shot of him looking over the highway rail and seeing a truck, that would put it together.
Yeah.
Again, not really a criticism. It, like, you know,
yeah,
I can only show so much, but I did check because I wondered if it had been, you know, visually telegraphed, and I don't think it was. But anyway, there's a truck there, and so he does the, hey, there's an accident. Can you go help? I'm going to call the, you know, call 911.
Go get an ambulance or something like that.
The guy is like, sure. Gets in his truck, goes underneath right as the goon car is in pursuit. They can't get through. Hey, back that thing up. Jim takes an access road back to the highway and then pulls a U on the highway to head back south, you know, on where he's actually going down to San Diego. And he has a big smile on his face.
Yeah, it's like, good. Looking a little pleased with himself. Mm-hmm. It was good.
It's like, yeah, it was a good one. Jim is settling up the bill at this restaurant that clearly he and Barbara just ate at, and we were cruelly kept from seeing what they were eating.
We'll get something later on for you.
We will. He joins Barbara as they walk along. It's like a cliff over the sea. So she fills him in on the backstory, on what is going on. Mm-hmm. She lived with Ralph until a couple of weeks ago. She saw Ralph kill a man named Saul Manti. It was night. It was late. They were having an argument that woke her up. She went downstairs to see what was happening, and the door to the like library they were in was open. She saw Ralph hit Saul with something, and he just dropped. It was dark. She didn't turn on any lights. She's pretty sure that Ralph couldn't have seen her, but it was just a matter of time until he started wondering if she'd overheard anything.
Mm-hmm.
She couldn't just leave. So to get an excuse to leave, she started talking about getting married, giving him ultimatums and starting arguments to give herself an excuse to leave. Saul was from Chicago. He was trying to move in on Denver, but Denver belongs to Ralph. So that was the source of their altercation. So Jim says, what you did by hiring me is you told him that he has something to worry about. So now he's not going to stop looking for you. You need to do what you should have done in the first place and give your story to the DA in Denver. And she says, how will we get back to Denver without getting killed? And Jim has a good, we? But of course, she needs his help, and he is going to end up helping her out. Okay, again, coming back to it now, what is her plan? I mean, maybe she doesn't have a plan, but...
But you mean in hiring Jim, or...
So, in hiring Jim, so, okay. So then she, when she left, it's unstated here, but we, you know, when she left, she also, like, took $50,000, because she was like...
Right, yeah.
I need this to live on while I figure out what to do.
I'm on the run.
I'm on the run. So she's worried she's being followed. She doesn't want to be found. So she hires Jim to make sure that she can't be found. Which, again, great premise with this kind of a second level of, by hiring Jim to find out if she can be found, she's able to establish that Ralph is, in fact, looking for her.
Yeah. So I guess the straightforward read of it is that she wants to be able to let her guard down.
She just wants to walk away.
Yeah. So she's like,
kind of,
am I safe here? I'm going to hire someone to find out if I'm safe here, but like to see if they can find me. And if they can, then I'll need to keep moving or whatever.
Right.
I think like, I don't think it's 100% like a rational decision that she's made. I think she's dealing with like constant anxiety or paranoia or whatever, mm-hmm. and thinks that this is a way to alleviate that. Mm-hmm. I think she's hoping that Jim doesn't find her, and that's going to make her feel safe.
Right.
And not only does Jim find her, not only does... Actually, he doesn't find her.
Yeah, he doesn't actually find her.
He doesn't actually find her. But like, you know, it pushes it to a point where she has to do the right thing.
Right.
Which may have been what she's trying to do all along, right? Like force herself into that spot.
Maybe. Yeah, I guess because so Jim still hasn't actually found her, but she knows that Ralph is looking for her. So she runs for Mexico, but then she stops before she gets to Mexico.
Yeah.
Because she needs Jim's. She says that she needs Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And she needs to help her with something, and she has to see him.
Right.
One thought I had is like, oh, does she need Jim to get her into Mexico? Like, maybe there's something there.
Possibly.
Like maybe she doesn't have a passport or something, right? Like,
yeah.
Or she does have a passport, but she doesn't want to use it because it'll be a paper trail, something like that. I'm like, that I was kind of expecting. And that just doesn't come up in this conversation. Like, the conversation is, here's the backstory, and then Jim being like, you know, you need to do the right thing.
Yeah.
There's no, like, but what I want to do is this.
Right.
So maybe she does want to be talked into it?
I think so. I think she doesn't want to run to Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Like, that was an impulse, and then she's like, this isn't actually what I want to do.
If she wanted to run to Mexico, she would have done it instead of hiring Jim to find her.
Sure. Yeah.
Right? Like, I think everything that's happening is her trying not to go so far away.
Mm. Right, because she doesn't go to, like, New York or something. She goes back to California where she grew up.
yeah. So there's a lot in this where she's not committed to running away, and that's the whole point to bringing Jim on board, I guess, is to tell her it's okay for her not to run away. Originally, she wants him to tell her that by saying, no, I can't find you, so nobody can.
Mm.
But then he's like, no, you have to face this head on. We're going to have to talk to the DA, because that guy, he's someone who's ready and willing to help you out.
Right, obviously. I'm not like, this doesn't make sense. This is a thing. It's more like I'm coming around to her whole deal really is an expression of the turmoil that she's experiencing.
Yeah.
And it's not like a plan.
Yeah. She's not the planning type in this outfit. Even though she clearly has plans to keep I've come by cab. I'm going to walk around. I'm going to, and then the other thing is just that, like, I also think it's possible that I am investing in a character trait for a situation where the story needed these two to meet and talk to each other again.
Right.
We're like, how do we, why, how, let's have her say she needs help.
So we go from there to a door with the lettering Morgan Tallman, Assistant DA, County of Denver. Mm-hmm. And we have a humorous beat here where Jim is getting impatient. He has been waiting for 2.5 hours. He's talking to, there's a secretary. She is in another episode of the Rockford Files. In addition to this role as Miss Connor, She is the receptionist in the family hour. Oh, she's, I think she's the woman at the juvenile detention center.
Right.
When he's like going to bring, what's her name there. And then he's like, I can't leave her here.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a wrap on Adrienne Rickard.
Mm-hmm.
She gets to be extremely blasé here as, her characterization is, I hear lots of things. Like, lots of people tell me lots of things. You'll see him when he's ready. I told him you're here, you know?
One of the things I love about this scene is the juxtaposition between the mundane and, like, Jim's very extraordinary reason for being there, right? Like, also, another thing I love about this scene is the clock on her desk.
Mm-hmm.
The face of the clock is glass, so you can look completely through it.
So you can see the hands moving with
Jim
in the background. Yeah.
It's good stuff.
It is good. Jim's like, you don't understand. I have information about the murder of a top racketeer.
Yeah.
And I want to talk to the DA. And she just gives him a look. And he's like, I'll wait. He goes and sits down on the couch next to a couple other guys. We cut to later that night as he is nodding off and then waking himself up when the door finally opens. And our DA, Morgan Tallman, is leaving. Jim intercepts him. I think Tallman says something like, where does it all come from? He wants to get home. He's been there since 7 a.m.
I know who killed Saul Mantee.
So do I.
You do?
So does everybody in Denver. His arrest made all the front pages here a couple of mornings ago.
Who did you arrest?
Small-time hood, Boyd Freeman.
You have the wrong man.
What are you talking about?
I'm a private investigator. My client came to Denver specifically to see you. I've got her hidden away until we can arrange police protection. She was an eyewitness to Saul Mantee's murder, and nobody named Boyd Freeman had anything to do with it.
You have a witness?
That's right.
I have a signed confession.
We get a good, confused look on Jim's face, which is... It's a little rare in the Rockford Files. It's not rare for Jim to be confused. It's just rare for Jim to be like, what?
Like, totally wrong. Like, he just...
Yeah.
He had it all mapped out.
Yeah.
And then this is like, oh, I have to reconsider my approach. I mean, it's never stated, but we'll get to the point where it's like, this guy was probably like bribed or leaned on or something to take the fall. There's an alternate episode where this is true and Barbara's story is false and Barbara has something else going on.
Right. Yeah.
And maybe in the end, it really is just to like steal money from Ralph and get away clean. That is also a plausible story that I was kind of expecting. Like, maybe that's where this goes.
One more twist at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jim is a little wrong footed. He goes to the motel where they're staying. Barbara doesn't open the door. He goes in. There's an open suitcase. The lights are on. She's not there. And then we see Jim pick up the broken deadbolt. We know something has happened. We go to Carell walking quickly with his men. And he has this great line. I was like, this has to be something. I don't think it is. I think it's just filling this time.
Yeah.
I don't want conversation. That guy couldn't wait to put on a price tag. Fine. I want what I paid for. It's that simple.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this has to be like the guy he paid off or something. It doesn't come back. I think it's just like, this is how he operates.
Yeah.
He says, hey, Vinny, throw me a piece.
Yeah,
he just has a gun thrown to him as he's walking up the stairs. So good.
That bit stuck out to me, and like it becomes important in the next scene or whatever, but it's unnecessary. Like, he could just have a piece on him.
He could, or it's like, I'm with my guys, I don't need a piece, but I'm going to be by myself, so I do.
Yeah, that could be, yeah.
I mean, again, he has this whole thing where he's like covering all angles, right?
Yeah.
He goes up to his room,
mm-hmm.
starts changing, goes into his closet, and then boom, Rockford ambush.
This is again Rockford hiding around the corner like a serial killer. Second time he's done this, like echoing the elevator scene. And it's great. Like, you rarely see him this. I'm trying to think of the word.
He's very physical in this episode in a way that he isn't as much, especially in later episodes. Like, sure, the occasional punch or whatever, but here the screenshot I just sent is he grabs Ralph in a full Nelson chokehold.
Yeah, and he's got this amazing threat with it. Like, he's got him in the hold, And he's like, you can't yell with a busted windpipe. You just kind of whistle.
Yeah.
From here on out, what takes place is Jim and Ralph.
In a deadly game of chicken.
Yeah. They lay threats on each other. And they're trying to decide how far either one of them is going to go. And it's great. Like I said early on, I wanted to see these two, and I am not disappointed by what they deliver here at the end.
So I sent you the screenshot. It's where he has him in the headlock. I was, you know, paused on this screen to take the screenshot. Simone walks by the room, comes in. It was over a little bit before her bedtime. She sees that I'm in here. She comes in and she goes, "Why is that dad killing that other dad?"
Oh, that's so good.
You know what? This picture is exactly described by that phrase.
You are. I mean, we're looking for a title for the next podcast, I think. Why is that dad killing that other dad? Oh, it's so good.
Oh, I just wanted to share that. Anyway, that dad does not, in fact, kill that other dad. He does grab his piece, says, "I won't hesitate to shoot you in the back," before letting him go. There's this sense here where Jim hates this guy, like in a way that I feel like we rarely see.
Yeah.
He just has this visceral, like, "I would happily kill you," which, again, is slightly more noir and less fourth season Jim Rockford.
The usual exchange of, like, the villain saying, "You wouldn't do it," right? But instead of him being like, "You wouldn't do it, you're too good of a person," he's like, "You wouldn't do it because there's my guys are downstairs."
"One shot from you. You got six guys up here make chopped liver out of you. One shot."
"You don't have to work so hard, Carell. I've been looking for a reason to pump one into you. I'll handle your goons later."
So I think this might now mark the earliest utterance of the phrase goons. I think we're theorizing about that from the last episode where he said something about goons. But Ralph has a line, "You won't shoot. You can't bluff if the other guy isn't scared."
Yeah.
And then again with Carell's, like, takes a moment to analyze the situation.
Yeah.
You kind of see that he's thinking through the options. And then he says, "You'd do it, wouldn't you, Jim?"
Yeah.
"You bet. What if I tell you that Barbara's okay? Jim doesn't want to be told. He wants to be shown."
Mm-hmm.
"What, are we going out the way you got in?" "No, we're just going to sit here, wait for your friends to go to sleep. Then we're just going to walk out the front door." And then Jim sits and he says, "You can stand right there," which is hell of a power play.
Yeah, it's so good.
We then cut to a car leaving out the front gates of this fancy house. We see Jim in the passenger seat. We can only assume that Carell is driving. After a beat, we hear an engine turn on and another car. So my notice just pulls out. It doesn't pull out of the same place. It was next to this driveway access area. So this other car slowly pulls out and follows Jim and Carell. And there's this kind of like low-key chase music as they slowly drive through Denver late at night.
My notes are that the other car has a banjo player and a piano player. Because these are the instruments we get.
Mm-hmm. We get to our climax here at the Carell Trucking Company. Jim keeps Carell covered as they go to a building with a sign for the employee entrance. Pounds on the door. "It's Carell, let me in." One of the goons, Broder, lets him in. He opens the door, sees Carell, then sees Jim, like, goes for his gun. And Carell says, "He has a gun in my back."
Yeah.
Do what he says. So Jim takes his gun. Barbara's sitting there. She has bruises on her face. And when she turns to see to look at them and we, you know, see her face, Carell snaps at his goon. "I told you not to touch her." There's something there, yeah.
Yeah.
Carell takes a step away from Jim, says, "You think you have it all wrapped up, but Howard's up there, and he has a gun on Barbara." So we see, indeed, Howard is up there. He indeed has a gun. Jim is standing next to Barbara. Barbara's sitting on, like, a couch, and there's, like, trucks in the background. He has a gun pointed at Carell. Carell and his goon are standing across from them. Near them has a gun. Howard is up on, like, a catwalk, has a gun pointing at Barbara. So,
yeah.
"Now, what we've got here is a standoff. I'm willing to play it out."
"So am I. I didn't get where I am by backing off the challenges. You can pump one into me if you want, only before you do,
You'd better say goodbye to Barbara.
And that's what gets Jim to acknowledge the situation and sigh and turn over his gun.
I know what a disappointment this must be.
You always cover yourself?
Always.
That's an important line that will come back.
Ralph tells Barbara that she should have come to him instead of the cops. They could have worked something out. Jim's like, what? Just a little thing like murder. Ralph snaps a little bit. I'm going to kill you myself. I'm really going to enjoy it. But Jim just can't resist. And who's going to take care of Barbara? I think Jim has identified that there is some kind of real feeling between the two of them.
This guy did not want to kill Barbara. Like, right. he was willing to let her go if he didn't think she was going to
go to the DA.
Go to the DA or anything like that. Like, let her go with 50 grand of his money. And so now, like, Jim is unarmed physically, but he's got this. He's like, well, maybe I've got this social angle.
There's still a weak point here.
Yeah, something I could put pressure on.
Krell yells at everybody to go outside, tells one of his goons to go get their car. And then there's this moment with him and Barbara where her a little more than him, but like they both have like tears in their eyes. Like,
it's
a really poignant moment where he says, this isn't the way I wanted it. Why didn't you keep running? You can get a long way on 50 grand.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was willing to just let it go. And then to him, now his hand has been forced, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, again, just like another level of the more interesting than average mob villain.
Right, yeah. He's not just a pending death threat.
A car suddenly shoots in from another direction. Someone yells, freeze, police! As Jim gets a final sucker punch in the remaining goon behind him and grabs his gun. So he covers Ralph as Ralph draws on him.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of them are pointing their guns at each other in another classic shootout position.
You keep yourself covered too.
Jim has a slow, like, come and get it, like, hand.
Yeah.
rock style.
Yeah.
The big hand, come and get it. It's very good.
The Rockford.
Jim the Rock Rockford is... ready to rumble. The cops grab Ralph, and again, just a little character thing. They like grab him, and he shakes him off with this look of like, "Don't touch me," you know, like, which is not uncommon, but it really fits here.
Yeah, it fits his character.
Barbara asks where they came from. When Jim saw that she was gone, he called the DA and explained and told them to put a tail on him. And I'm like, "Oh right, there was that other car." Like, I had completely forgotten, even though it was just like a minute ago. So that was the Denver cops were tailing him. And then she looks off camera and goes,
"What'll they do to him?
Do you care?"
"I care."
Yeah.
That, I think, would have been a fine place just to end the episode.
Well, so that's the thing. This is the noir ending, right?
Hmm.
It's bittersweet. It's sad because obviously she's upset about this, everything that's happened and how this has come about. But they're like, okay, so we have our noir ending. Now we have to have our Rockford ending.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's some good Rockfordishness in this ending. But what I wanted to bring up is the moment in the DA's office when Jim looked surprised. As we go through this time, you know, this often happens to us while we discuss the episode. That could be Jim like, what? Or it could be Jim going, oh, now I see his plan.
Mm-hmm.
Because we see Jim go to her hotel room, but Jim is not expecting her to be there, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I think he knows if this guy sends someone to confess for his crime, and the DA's already got that, then no DA's gonna, like, Jim can be tied up for a while at the DA's office and he can go and grab her. It's one of these things where this doesn't have to pan out this way. It doesn't have to be the way that what this episode is saying, but it fits nicely if these two are just playing this game of 3D chess, right? Like, they're trying to guess at what each other, because the ending bit where Ralph talks to Jim and says, "You keep yourself covered, nice." There's a begrudging respect.
Yeah.
Okay, you've outplayed me. You did. I thought I had you, but yeah, it's good stuff.
I buy that. There's no like indication of like how Ralph found out that they were there. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't matter. He's clearly
a
pro.
He's been on top of Jim the whole time.
Right. Yeah. So we don't need to see that in particular. But yes, that is the noir ending, and now we get the Rockford Files ending. which starts yes. with Jim and Barbara on the pier eating tacos.
Yes.
I'd have to, maybe I'll get into the numbers closer to the end of our run, but there's a, I think there may be a higher density of
tacos in the first season.
Taco to episode in the first season than in later seasons.
Yeah.
I mean, he's always eating tacos, but I feel like he's eating tacos in pretty much every episode in the first season. Yeah. And it drops off. Anyway, they're together. She's saying that it feels good to be out and around people, not hiding.
Mm-hmm.
Jim can't let this go. How did you get mixed up with a guy like Ralph Carell? And she says, I don't know. I just fell in love with him. He was fun and exciting, a warm, gentle. And then Jim finishes the sentence, killer. And she says, I don't want to talk about Ralph. There's an indication here. I mean, the whole time there's been an indication of Jim being like, she needs my help.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
The story he has in his head is like, now that she's free of this guy, she can be her own person.
Yeah.
As Jim Rockford is wont to moralize in other episodes, like, you can make your own decisions. You don't need to be beholden to this man, especially a criminal like him, a killer like mm-hmm. him. And that's kind of glossing over the emotional reality of, like, they do actually seem to have been in love, I think, is what this show is telling us. So that's complicated. He gives Barbara his bill, all of his itemized expenses for their little vacation to Denver.
Here we go.
She balks. Money is a problem.
Yeah.
How do you go through 50 grand in 2 weeks? It's not really her money. She's planning to return it. She only took it because she was so desperate. Plus,
but you're an honest man. You wouldn't want that kind of money. Jim? Would you?
Yeah, I would.
And we have a freeze frame as she pats his arm with a smile as he looks off into the distance like, oh, really? Great facials.
It's good.
End our episode on the note of, at least he already has the cash he gave her, right?
Right, right. It's almost a grand, right?
It's 1,200 total because...
1,200, yes, the two 600s.
Yeah, yeah. Minus 425 for the spare ribs.
Right, yeah, and other expenses. So, yeah, it was a decent amount of money. Yeah, I love it. I love that they gave us the noir ending and then turned around. They were like, okay, but you're here for tacos and Jim being...
not getting money.
screwed out of his cash.
Yeah.
So, yeah, enjoy.
Enjoy.
Which is what we did.
Yeah, then we did. Shout out to Starsky.
Yeah.
Paul Michael Glazer. Ralph Carell is one of the more memorable mob bosses. I think that's very cool. It's always a little incredible to me how much character stuff can end up packed into these when they're not like character centric episodes.
Yeah, this isn't like a portrait of Elizabeth. Yeah. Wait, no, this isn't a portrait of
Barbara.
Ralph.
Or Ralph.
But yeah.
It's the Carell who saw the alligators.
Yes. we started this episode talking about just how strong the Rockford Files were on making even incidental characters memorable, right? Like, and yeah, I think they've done like a really good job here. Yeah, I would watch the first season of the Rockford Files based on this episode alone.
And it's only 8 in, so that's a good forecast for the rest of it.
Yes.
I think we mentioned a little bit at the top, or maybe before we started recording, that it is maybe in comparison to other ones, it felt very straightforward to watch. Like, the story has some twists and turns, but the actual episode is very linear. Yeah, not in a bad way, but it does feel like, okay, we talked about it. Like, there's not a whole lot else I have to say about it, I don't think.
Yeah. Strong episode, tightly written, and just fun. Just a fun one.
A fun one. Not necessarily a romp. I'm not quite sure what defines what line this is on that romp is on the other side of.
But it's definitely not on the romp side.
But it is maybe because of the noir stuff. And also just the sense of Jim has more of a sense of violence in this one that I think
is
muted later. And so that makes it a little more raw, I guess, a little more like a noir.
The ambushes he set up.
The deadly ambushes.
Yes.
Yeah. But this is just a matter of like little tiny degrees on a pretty big spectrum, I think, where we're really like dialed into like these kind of nuances. Yeah. I would tell someone to watch this episode.
I would too. Specifically, I think I would make a pact with someone earlier in the week to watch this episode than talk about it on a podcast.
My only other thing that coming away from it is I feel like the premise is such a strong premise, and I feel like, not like it didn't live up to it, but the whole, like, I want you to find me.
There's a promise and a premise like that that feels like it's the big twist, right?
Yeah.
Where it's actually revealed quite early on why she wants him to find her, right? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of like a sort of an example. The Maltese Falcon is got kind of like strange, attractive woman shows up and is like, Mr. Sam Spade, I need you to find my friend, I think is what it, no, find my sister. I can't remember what the setup is at the very beginning, but it, like, and then it just twists and turns all the way down.
It's not really like this, but the vibe is similar to me as North by Northwest, where the start of that is people treating Cary Grant like a person that he isn't.
Yeah.
And then, you know, things just escalate from there. And,
yeah,
you know, you do find out eventually why, but the reveal of why is kind of like subservient to the larger arc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something like that. It is a very strong premise. It's very like, ooh, I want to see where this is going. And
yeah,
there are other stories spinning out from that premise that I think might be a little more, because my brain is damaged from thinking about con game stuff, like that would be a little more
right,
like layered in that onion way where one discovery is obscuring the truth in a different way.
Yeah. What is she roping him into?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is she up? And that would probably center on her having an agenda.
Yeah.
About something in particular, while this story is more, I think you've made a persuasive case for, it's really a story of someone who's like spinning out of control and just trying to
find some way to
pull things back together. Yeah. Anyway, that's down the road of an episode that this isn't.
Yes.
We can talk a lot about an episode that this isn't.
Yeah.
You know, I think we've done a pretty good job about talking about the episode that this is.
That was.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, we are bidding goodbye to Lawrence Doney. We'll be moving on to our ever narrowing list. So we're actually going to be going through the rest of the season one episodes, except for the
first one.
The first one. Yeah, so we'll be going through the rest of our season one episodes for our next couple episodes of the show. And then we start getting into closing down some of our longest running contributors. And then we go from there.
Yeah.
So if you really wanted to extrapolate from here, you could go through our whole back catalog and see which season one episodes we haven't done yet. But until then, you can, I guess, stay waiting by your podcast machine.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that is all to say that we will be back next time to talk about another episode of The Rockford Files.